Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, a product of the Health Policy Research Consortium, a CTIS program, your weekly podcast empowering communities to use policy as a vehicle to improve their health and learn how to mobilize your community to create positive change where you live, work, and worship. Wait not a minute more. It's time to get started with the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast.
Welcome to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. I'm your host, Patricia Terrell. Our guest today is Dr. Doris Brown, the president of the National Medical Association. Dr. Brown is going to talk about health policy and the importance of diversity in the healthcare industry. Dr. Brown, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
And let's get started by having you to define public policy so that our listeners will understand what it means and how public policy affects health policy.
Thank you. Yes. Well, I look at public policy as being a guide to actions that are taken, and the policies are usually generated by government or other organizations or institutions, and it impacts how we function within our communities.
When it comes to health policy and with the current administration, what are some things that we need to know about?
Well, with this current administration and looking at public health policies, things are changing almost every day because we are seeing our laws being impacted or threatened to be changed based upon what the administration is seeing as a new direction that we should be taking. And as an example, we can look at bills that are there that have been impacted, the Affordable Care Act being one of them. There are other bills and acts that have been passed by Congress that are now being threatened. We currently have, and what is going on in the House today and tomorrow, will be the CHIP, which is the Children Health Insurance Program, is being threatened to be changed, or at least the funding may not get its refunding authorization that it's previously had because it expired with our current funding that was at the end of September 30th. And tomorrow they will look at the community health centers. Again, two programs that are seriously important for the health care of minorities and vulnerable populations in this country.
So why don't we talk about the National Medical Association, of which you are the president. I believe that's the 118th president you are.
Yes, I am the 118th president of the National Medical Association. The National Medical Association, as we call it, NMA, was founded in 1895 out of the need for black physicians to care for their patients and to organize around how to provide the best care for them. So we had five individual physicians that really were very concerned because they could not treat their patients in hospitals, and if they admitted the black patients, they would be cared for by the majority population. And because they had that concern, they organized and, of course, was not allowed to become members of the medical societies that were available at the time, such as the American Medical Association. And because of that denial, they founded the National Medical Association, and we have been organized all of that time since then. A couple of years there were presidents that obviously stayed more than one term, and so that's why it's now probably in our 122nd year, but I'm the 118th president.
Well, congratulations, because that's a recent installment for you, right?
Yes, I was installed on August 1st of this year. So it's only been a couple of months.
So let me ask you this, Dr. Brown. Why is it important for our healthcare workforce to be diverse?
Well, of course, we know, and several studies have shown, that people like to be cared for by people that look like them and understand their culture and their background. And even in situations where language becomes a problem, we feel more comfortable in having that discussion. And, of course, that applies to our professional schools. And we know that minority providers, the numbers are very low. Starting, at medical schools that way back in the 60s, when minority students did not fare well in medical school or had difficulties attending medical school, the pipeline was really very, very small. And so we didn't have enough providers to take care of the patients that's in our community. We were not certainly at the 12 or 13% as we are represented in the population.
And I understand, too, that there are some barriers to the work that you're doing to diversify the workforce that public policy could resolve. Can you tell us what some of those issues are and how public policy can be a solution?
Well, let me go back and just say just a little bit about way back in the early part of the 60s when we were less than 1% of the African-American medical students. We then sort of grew to about 12% in 1994. And then, of course, we had the affirmative action, anti-affirmative action movement to take place. And so that number sort of plateaued and has been decreasing. And I think the data, I believe, from 2014 shows that minority students or African-American students only represent 8% of the medical student population. Well, as our population grow, and of course we are plagued with having a higher percentage of most of the chronic diseases impact us in a greater way than the majority population, that means that with the disproportionate number in medical school and graduating from school and going on to provide care for patients, I should also say we also have an aging population of healthcare providers that will be out of the workforce capacity very soon. And so what we are left with is a dearth of providers that can care for the number of patients that we are likely to see in the minority community. Some other problems end up being the high cost of medical education and whether we are going to be able to afford the rising cost of a medical school education. Many of the schools have certainly topped the $50,000 a year, and so when you have undergraduate student loans and now you add on top of that medical school student loans, you're coming out of a medical professional school and you can have a debt up to $300,000, which is not a way to start your young life of can you buy property, can you have a family, can you continue to live. Of course, that again seeps into what about scholarships, and many of the scholarships are drying up that we previously had in the early part of the 70s. And so minority students are really suffering in terms of getting the ability to matriculate in medical schools. The Association of American Medical Colleges developed a program because of the imbalance in terms of minority students. They created a project called 3000 by 2000, and this was in the late 60s, 1968, I believe, because they understood that there was not enough minority students that was interested in medicine and or academically prepared to go on and matriculate in medical schools. And so they started this program to really kind of increase the numbers. And as I indicated, early on, the numbers did go up to the 12% in the early part of the 1990s. But then we were plagued with people saying we're taking the seat of majority students that could be there and provide more in terms of the community, and several cases even went to court. And so then you had laws that were passed that really did impact the numbers of minority students, and so the numbers started to plateau because you can't look at quotas, as some people call it, to get into medical schools. So again, the National Medical Association has been really working trying to address this problem with the physician shortage. We are really concerned about the pipeline and trying to come up with innovative ways to get around all of the obstacles that are there, which is very much similar to getting around some of the obstacles that are around the policies that are being created to get care to the minority population.
So I take it the pipeline, there's not enough in the pipeline, enough people in the pipeline to offset the number of doctors that are leaving due to retirement and aging?
Absolutely. And then there are other issues. Of course, the
minority providers are not being paid as much in terms of taking care of patients and getting reimbursed under the Medicare and Medicaid and other government programs, because that whole system now is trying to get to what we call a value-added program. But we know that many of the minority providers are certainly not getting the same payment for the same care in certain situations. I think that the National Medical Association, of course, we are partnered with and have as part of our membership the four minority medical schools that are in the country, the Charles Drew Medical School in California, the Morehouse Medical School in Georgia, the Meharry Medical School in Tennessee, and the Howard Medical School in the Washington, D.C. And so looking at that enrollment, of course, trying to get students that are just interested in STEM programs, and that has been throughout the country, not just for minority students, but trying to get students interested in STEM or STEAM. So you have to look at the K through 12 students and really trying to get them to get interested in the science program so that you can then build on the pipeline, and putting in other mechanisms to make sure that they do well as young students in high school and in undergraduate school so that they are academically prepared to go on to medical school and, of course, compete with anyone. And I do think that we have many, many fantastic students that have gone through and matriculated well. Many of them are graduating not only with MD degrees, but also MD PhDs, which is sort of a dual program. So they are interested in research as well as clinical care.
And when you look at the challenges of becoming a doctor today versus back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, or 90s, is it more complicated? If so, why? Or if it's not, explain why not.
Complicated now. When you graduated and went through your training programs, you could then get out and decide that you were going to start your practice. You may have joined with one of your classmates and you had a small practice of two or three individuals, or you joined with a group. Well, the system has changed significantly. We now have larger corporations that are taking over, and you're part of a provider group, so that the solo practitioner is probably very, very limited, and not many of them left in this country now, at least from a minority standpoint, because of all of the requirements of keeping pace. There's so many things that governmental policies have put into place, and yes, many of those are put into place to make sure that our patients receive the best possible care and that it is safe and affordable. But in many cases, it's not affordable for the minorities if they do not have insurance that's going to cover it. And that's why the Affordable Care Act was so important for the 23 million individuals that did not have health care. This afforded them the opportunity to get health care. And, of course, we all know that that has been under attack, and so many of those rules are changing. And as I've indicated, the CHIPS program, which is for the students and children, that has certainly now being discussed and debated whether it will get refunded. And so that means that many of our children will not have the health care that they need because they are not covered. Many minorities work part-time jobs, and so therefore they do not have the kind of coverage and other benefits that you would have if you were a full-time employee. And so there are many other problems that really have been impacting individuals in terms of policies that are there and affecting how we practice our medicine. And so many people join into prepaid health plans and other group practices. And then, of course, there are a number of rules that you have to follow by. Just to give you a story that I heard of an individual that was working with one of the large plans, and of course, in those larger systems, time is money. And so you are allowed the 15 to 20 minutes to see your patients, and you have to move on. And this was an individual that really wanted to connect with her patients, and so she spent more time talking with them. She was warned in the first month that you're going too slow. At the end of the day, you have several patients that are still here. You can't spend time talking with individuals. You have to provide the care. If they come in with a headache, you take care of the headache. You don't say, oh, they have a headache and they have high blood pressure and all of the other things that may be connected. And she was going through that kind of history, getting the information. They said, no, the visit was for headache. Take care of that headache. You have them get another appointment to come back to address those other issues. Well, after a couple of warnings, they then decided that perhaps we'll have to put you on probation, and if you don't speed it up, we'll have to terminate you. And so this person decided it was best for her to leave the practice because she didn't fit in with that culture. Well, many times, particularly with senior African-American patients, you don't get the kind of history. They take a little longer to give you that information. Well, if you're in a system where time is money, you don't have time to go through all of those questions to interact and build that relationship. This was what many of the providers would say, oh, I didn't get into medicine to practice like that. Well, the system has changed, and so if we're going to keep up, then we really have to address it and deal with those kinds of policies.
Help me to understand, Dr. Brown, what caused this major shift in caring for the individual, where it's all about money now?
As I said, I think it became more of an economic situation, and it's not just about care. It's big business.
Yeah.
And so when providers have sort of lost control of the healthcare industry, it became big business. And so, again, you have to then look at it from a business standpoint rather than a caring institution.
Once the corporations got involved, basically, then
yes.
It becomes the bottom
yes.
line. Wow.
And then, of course, we have the insurance field that, you know, again, you must pay certain things or you can't afford certain things because it's not covered. What we really should be focusing on is preventive health care, because we know that preventive care is less costly than the treatment care that we're getting because we continue to treat. But if we just do some education and lifestyle modification up front, we wouldn't have the level and degree of chronic diseases that we are impacted with today.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And it's almost like we're in a catch-22 type of situation, because in order to modify your behavior, then they're going to have to eat better. And then when you're looking at low-income people and their ability to afford better quality food, which is more expensive, it's like you're caught in this rock and a hard spot.
Yes. Well, we all know that from a public health standpoint, we've talked about the social determinants of health. And it's not just about the individual free from disease, but it's about the entire well-being of that individual. That's where they live, where they work, where they play, what they eat, whether they are in a food desert. So when all of those things then take into consideration the health of the individual, we can improve it if we try to modify many of the social determinants. Yet, as I say, when we have medicine that is focused on the big business part of it, we're only looking at the health care, and you really have to look at the entire spectrum.
Well, let me ask you, what is NMA, the National Medical Association, doing in terms of working with policymakers to change some of what you're talking about?
That's very good. Thank you so much for asking that. My program year, I have developed a national action plan for health equity, and it is a collaborative approach that is joining with, because we keep focusing on silos. And so I've reached out to join with the nurses and the dentists, the social workers, the pharmacists, the healthcare executives, the public health individuals, with the health association. And we're going to bring in our policymakers at the state, local, and national level with our social organizations to get the word out, our lawyers, and our media to then build build on this national action plan to really look at what policies do we really need to affect. Many things are going back to the states. I mean, we talk about the Medicare program and putting funds into states. Well, we know that certain states did not want to participate in the Affordable Care Act, so of course those individuals did not sign up under federal program, and it means that the care for them and what they'll have in that state is going to be less. And if you give back to the states how they're going to regulate many of the programs, many of the states might opt out. So there's a segment of the population that will not have the availability of the kind of care that they will have in another area. And so the National Medical Association is looking at those kinds of things. And as I've indicated, with our National Action Plan of Health Equity, in working together as a unified collaboration, we believe that with our partnerships and with every segment of our society, we can then make a change in terms of our determinants of health. And of course, this does not leave out our student National Medical Association. It does not leave out our consumers, our patients that are part of this, and that's why we will involve our social organizations and our faith-based organizations that will help us to increase the education, to get the patients involved and engaged, letting us know what it is they need and what it is they want so that we can address it, and then working with our policymakers in Congress, at the state legislature level, and at the local level with our mayors.
And what can we do on an individual level to help affect health policy?
Take an active role, become a registered voter, and get out and vote. And when you see things that really going to impact you, don't wait for somebody else to make a change. I think we need to pick up the phone. We need to let our representatives that we've elected to go to Congress or to serve as mayor or to serve in the state legislature. We voted for all of them. We need to let them know that we are out there, that we want our voices heard. So you should call, you should write letters, you should send faxes. Make sure that you are on their radar. Show up wherever they are, if it's a town hall meeting, and let your voices be heard.
Awesome. I mean, we all want to vote during the presidential elections, but these midterm and off-season elections are the most important, are they not?
Oh, that is very critically important. And what the National Medical Association has done is we have within our convention that will happen in August of this year, we have that what we call in our exhibit area where the physicians will come by, information on voter registration, and we are asking our physicians, take this information back to your offices, display it, talk to your patients about registering and getting out and voting. 2018 is really very critical. We tend to, as you've indicated, focus on the presidential election, but we know midterm elections are also critically important, and we have to take an active role in that. I know that there were several people that said, oh, they didn't vote in the general election because, oh, what difference does it make? And I've had conversations with the individual. It doesn't make a difference whether I vote or not. Every single vote makes a difference. And if people understand the history of how we had to work to get the Voting Rights Act passed, they would understand that it's critically important. This is a right that you have, and you have to exercise that right by going to the polls and voting.
Absolutely. And if your vote was not important, there wouldn't be so many issues surrounding redistricting.
Absolutely. That's why it's critically important, and we need to then do that more. And also, I think a piece that we haven't yet thought about is we need to really start to mentor our young people to be ready to take political office. I think that's an area that we have not really addressed very well. So we really need to start to look at those individuals, whether they're in high school or college, and you may serve as president of your student association, and then you move on, you don't have an interest in that. But you can make a difference. Look at your community. Become a council person. Groom yourself and groom individuals to go on to become mayors and state representatives, and then move on to Congress.
Absolutely. That was President Obama's message when he left office, is to get involved and run for office.
Absolutely. And we need to have more and more. I know, you know, with the number of individuals we have in Congress now, they're very concerned. They represent us. They want to hear from us. But I think not just the minority representatives in Congress, all of them are there. We only get two senators per state, and if you're in Washington, D.C., you don't get any. But you have to call upon the others because, again, we can cross a state line so easily, so the laws that are in one state really impacts you. Doesn't matter where you live. So I believe in calling them up and sending them emails, and if you're getting into some of the social media things that I don't really do tweets and all of that, but there are people that love it, so get out there and tweet back and make a difference. Let your voices be heard.
Absolutely. Well, definitely you're doing some great things. And is there anything else that maybe I did not cover that you would like to add?
Well, again, talking about the program for the National Action Plan for Health Equity, we kicked it off in September with the Congressional Black Caucus. The second phase of it, where we're bringing in our legislators and our social groups and our faith base, will occur in March in the Washington, D.C. area at our Health Legislative Colloquium. And then we will follow that up with the third phase, where we will talk about what has worked, what needs to be changed, what needs to just be tweaked, and whether we are actually making a difference, because we will be collecting data along the way, and that will occur at our annual convention, which is going to be held in Orlando, Florida, in August. So, yes, those are three very important key pieces of what's going on. And, of course, we work throughout the year. We have six regions within the National Medical Association and 127 local affiliate organizations. And so working with them at the regional and local levels, as well as some state societies that are there, is really critical. Getting more engaged. Many members have not registered and paid their dues, but we want to get them actively involved to come back and be a part of the National Medical Association and help us to make a difference, because there are many bills that will come through Congress that will impact our resources and our health care, whether it is Pell grants for students that are in school that may go on in the STEM programs to become providers of the future, whether it is the tax codes that's going to impact our pocketbooks and what we pay and what we can have for deduction, or the rising cost of health care in medical schools where we can't afford to go because we don't get a scholarship. So all of those things are really important. And I should say, when you're in medical school and you don't have the ability or know where your next payment is coming from, it becomes a major stressor. And so mental health is an issue that we have focused a lot on, but it impacts how we live and where we work and how we are going to survive. So we have to then also address the mental health issues as well.
Okay, and let us know what your website is. Where can people learn more about what you're doing with the National Medical Association?
NMANET.org. So www.nmanet.org.
Okay. Dr. Brown, this has been a most enjoyable interview. I really want to thank you for all of the work that you're doing for health policy and diversity in the healthcare industry. Okay. We've been speaking with Dr. Doris Brown, the president of the National Medical Association, and we've been talking about health policy and the importance of diversity in the healthcare industry. Thank you again, Dr. Brown, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast. Remember, you have the power to use policy to improve your picture of health where you live, work, and worship. For more information on the Health Policy Research Consortium podcast, visit our website at www.hprc.info and like us on our social media channels, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr.
The research and information that we report during this show was supported by the National Institute on Minority Health and Health Disparities of the National Institutes of Health under award number 5U54MD008-60802. The content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the National Institutes of Health.